I'm Paula Gordon. What a pleasure to be with Elizabeth Strout.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
How does it be to be able to write for The New Yorker and for the Oprah magazine? To me, that is, there's something magical about that.
Well, you know, a story is a story. And
is a story,
yeah.
Says a rose is a rose is a rose,
rose, rose, rose, rose, rose, rose, rose, right? Exactly. It's just, which is something I sometimes think about. A story is a story, and it can speak to, hopefully can speak to many, many people. And there aren't, unfortunately, that many venues left for short stories right now, which is, I think, very sad, because people need them. I believe people need them. So if you pick up O Magazine or you pick up The New Yorker and you can read something where you just feel that little bit of sense of understanding about something that happened to you or something that happened to somebody, just whatever it is that we look for of like, oh yeah, right.
How many words does it take to do a short story? I really ask that as a technical question.
I never understood the whole word thing because I don't do math well enough. But I think a short story is typically around 10 pages, but mine are usually longer.
Well, I ask that because you would think that, I mean, if you could, for instance, tell a short story almost like a haiku,
yeah,
in, say, 1,200 words, which is really, 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 really hard.
Yeah.
You could probably get in a USA Today or someplace that has, I mean, we could create a genre. Because clearly,
right,
with the explosion of book clubs and poetry readings and things, people want it.
Yeah.
And at some point, people are going to have to demand it to get it.
Right, right.
My question, so then, is a technical one. When I'm writing things, I'm usually at 500 or 600 words. It drives me crazy. But there's a discipline to the shortness. And
right,
perhaps we could...
right.
There, or do a praise for the short story,
yeah,
for the book. For
yeah,
the...
yeah, yeah. And there is, what they call short shorts, and that's sort of a genre. And I think I'm too much of a blabbermouth to be able to get it much shorter myself. But I think it's great when people can, and it may be that will become even more available.
I had not thought about short shorts, but that probably is something one could do.
Right.
But boy, would that be
pages.
Hard.
Yeah.
Have
yeah.
you ever tried it?
No.
I just think it would be immensely difficult.
I haven't. Because I find myself stretching out, too much into the...
Well, without those
the
details...
The slant of sun or in the...
Well, it wouldn't be you, would it?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Although, never say never. We don't know.
Indeed.
It doesn't look it, though.
When I think about all the people I know, half of them are out of books.
What do you mean out of books?
I mean people who have never existed outside the mind of the writer.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, well, that's wonderful.
Well, that makes a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
If we evolved, as the anthropologists tell us, to live in groups of maybe 8 or 12 and the most people you'd see in your life was 100... What do you do with thousands of people in your brain?
Well, I guess you wait for some of them to come forward and some of them to move back, and then someone else takes a little turn on the stage. And
you have people doing so many different things. How do you when I think about somebody writing a book? How do you know that many things? Are you a reader as well as a writer?
It's interesting. Oh, I'm a voracious reader. I read all the time. If I'm not writing, I'm reading, and I feel like I'm doing my work. It's a wonderful way to not feel guilty, because then I'm reading. I think I'm doing my job.
What do you read?
Oh, I read. I very often go back to the classics and reread. I'll reread Edith Wharton and Virginia Woolf and Middlemarch and Tolstoy, and I'm always rereading, because every time I read it, it's a different book to me, and I think, where was I the last time I read this a few years ago? Because now it's all, it's different. But
And were in a different place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm always, telling my students, read a book again in a few years. You won't even know you read it, because you're different somehow.
And
it's a different story.
Isn't that what education is also about, to give you that first time so you've got
right.
it done?
That's right, because if you're not exposed to it, then how do you know? You know, it took me, I think, 4 different classes of T.S. Eliot before I finally said, oh, my God. You know, and then...
I'm still number 2.
Yeah.
Well, to be able to get access to people who clearly are onto some big magic takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
And in America, we don't like that part.
No, I don't think so. But certainly poetry has helped. I mean, I did... In college, I think it was my mother exposed me to a lot of American literature, but college exposed me to a lot of poetry, and I loved that poetry. You know, Tennyson, you know, all the older poets and also some of the more contemporary ones. And I have I belong to the Poetry Society or whatever, so, you know, whatever it is. So that poetry is constantly coming into my apartment, and that's very very important to me, because I've often thought that poets have an access to something that's really pretty magical.
And you tell me that John Berryman, in just one line, it's just elegant. John Berryman, well, I didn't know who John Berryman was. Whoa, who's John Berryman? Ooh. The ability to plant little things in my head must make you feel sort of like a goddess.
Oh, I wish. I wish. Mostly mostly the work of a writer is a very solitary, strange kind of existence. That particular story that you're referring to with Berryman's line, you know, I wanted to get that right. I'm absolutely compulsive about making sure that I can get as close to the bone for the truth of a story. And I went to the library and I read everything I could about that particular condition that's in that story in Coming Tide, and used every aspect of my own emotional experience to try and push it to the extreme to get to the point where I could write about Kevin Colson.
And yet you always give me enough, but you leave room for me many, many places to fill it in.
Yeah.
It's just remarkable how I'm certain I know what you're saying, whether it's true or not.
Well,
I have a certainty that and whether it's true or not doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't, because it's your book.
Yeah.
Once I write it and I give it to the reader, I'm very big on a relationship with the reader. I write for a reader who will need it, understand it, on whatever level they understand it. That's their, you know, everybody will come to a book bringing their own life's experiences, and they will see it in their own way, and they should. So my job is to give the reader something that's on some level true enough that they can respond to it with their own life's experiences.
I don't want to go too far from poetry before saying that our next-door neighbor is Thomas Lux, who is a wonderful poet.
Absolutely fabulous,
and has introduced me back into poetry. And his ability to go someplace that I think I've looked at and see something that never occurred to
me. Exactly.
Is that poetic essence also to be found in any great writing?
I think so. I think that they're hopefully quite closely connected. Yeah, absolutely. Those glimpses, those visions, the completely or hopefully original way of rendering it, the use of language that can produce a completely different sense of something that seemed familiar and becomes familiar in a new way. And then there's just the plain old rhythm. You know, I love the way a sentence falls on the ear. And so much contemporary stuff I read, I'm appalled, frankly, that the writer doesn't seem to be understanding that the ear has to be addressed. You know, there's so many things that go into a piece of writing. There's the emotional truth. There's the story itself. Is it going to leave somebody feeling that they've been through an experience that was worthwhile? But then there's also the way it sounds on to the ear.
Which takes me to music.
Yeah.
Isn't that sort of the third leg on the stool?
I think so. I think it should be. And I recently heard somebody say, oh, there's no point in writing a good sentence anymore because nobody cares. And, you know, that's pretty depressing. And Maybe it's true. I can't believe it's true.
And besides,
if it is, I don't want to think about it.
Well,
because I believe the way a sentence sounds is connect. Style is substance.
Mm.
And I believe that. Mm-hmm. And the way a sentence sounds and the density or the muscularity of a sentence is going to be connected to the heft of the story or the...
The philosopher Frederick Fauré talks about the need for a sense of beauty, a sense of feeling. He first uses the word emotion. Then he says, no, let's talk about feeling. It has more muscularity.
Mm-hmm.
That denseness matters,
yes,
too, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It absolutely does. And when I, I'll read stories or something, or it'll come across my, some subject that's very, serious. I mean, humans, our lives are serious. I don't mean they're not hysterically funny. They are. But this is serious stuff we're all trying to do here. And so when I see sentences that are just like sort of spun off without a care, then it's directly affecting the experience of the emotional impact of that story, the gravitas, the resonance that one is hoping to strike.
And we see that in television.
Yes,
and we see
exactly.
That in most
all the time.
Of in the junk radio.
Junk. It's
and
like eating.
You are what you eat.
Exactly. That's right. And we're just all shoving more and more Twinkies in our mouths, and it's...
No Twinkies here. We'll be back in just a moment with the real deal. This is Elizabeth Strout. I'm Paula Gordon. Be with us when we return.